Everybody, I'm George Anderson, and we're going to be studying the Gospel of Mark. We're not going to do it in the micro way of looking at each word of each verse, because it's got 15 chapters plus a little more, and some we're going to have to be covering if we want to cover the book. And I always think it's nice to do a whole book, because you get a better feel for how things are put together. We're going to cover the whole book this week. And therefore, we're going to have to go at the rate of about 3 chapters a day. So today, we're going to deal with chapters 1 through 3. But in addition to that, we'll get a little introduction on the whole structure of Mark, so you understand what's going on and how I'm going to deal with it. Many of us, when we think about the Gospels, think about them as histories of Jesus' life. We look at the Gospels as sort of the chronology of Jesus' life, and then the epistles and the other books of the New Testament as more topical, dealing with specific issues. But we have to remember right from the beginning that when we talk about history, we're talking about it from a very, very special perspective. That is, we're Western Europeans, and we've been very influenced by the way history has been taught and studied in the last 200 years. For most of us, when we think about history, we think, and I hope you can, if you can't see this, let me know. I can do a little shoving this way. Is it okay for you there?
Sure.
Most of us think of history as a line, and we start here, and this cause leads to that effect. So it's first this, and then that, and then that, and that, and that, and that. And so history becomes a series of events which are kind of strung together along a trail. And I guess that's why most people see history as a kind of ho-hum thing. You know, all history. I'm a history teacher. That's my trade. I was introduced earlier at the first sitting as teaching at Luther College. And then someone said, oh no, he doesn't really teach. He's president at the college. And it reminded me of all those jokes about college presidents that you always hear. They're all written by faculty people. Faculty people are very bright, so they have very good jokes about college presidents. And one of the latest I heard was of the two college presidents who drowned. The truck they were riding in fell into the lake, and they were riding in the back of the truck, and they weren't able to get the tailgate open, so they both drowned. It's that kind of story you always hear. Well, anyway, as a historian, I'm used to people say, oh, history, I never really cared much for that. And they kind of yawn and sometimes get a little nauseous. And I think that's because they see history as Henry Ford once said, one damn thing after another. And it just kind of plods along. We all had to learn history as a bunch of dates. But history may be that way. Most of us experience history, though, in a different way. And most of us experience history as life. And I have life here as a series of pictures. Because most of us, as we think back in our life, think about it as like an album. There are those experiences. In fact, sometimes it's the family album or our own pictures that remind us of certain events. I know I have pictures of myself as a little child up at Bishop Creek in California, in a little stockade that my parents built out of sticks to keep me sort of located while they were camping. And that then, and so we have those childhood pictures of who we are, and then we have pictures of our, maybe Christmas 1968 or my birthday. Then there are the wedding pictures or our trip to Argentina or whatever big things happened in your life along the way that was a big thing. Maybe it was college for you or living in another part of the country. Then life goes on with other pictures, and finally maybe it begins to branch out again with grandchildren, or we start tracing our family tree and we get some ancestors' pictures in, or we start going to hold them and take back pictures from that. So life tends to be a series of memories of individual events. And that's precisely the way the Gospels were put together. They are albums. They are snapshot albums. The Gospel of Mark has perhaps 75 snapshots. 75 little units, little stories, individual incidents. And in Mark, they are not put together in a very scientific way. You don't see 13 days later, or 12 days after this, or a year and a half later. Mark tends to jump from picture to picture with the word immediately. In the old King James, it was straightway, and straightway he went. There's very little time sequence in Mark. Mark is not like a modern history book. It's more like either life or a TV drama, which may be the same. I don't know. If TV drama are supposed to be real life dramas, then they ought to, in some way, parallel life experience. And I have played with that idea. Maybe they do. Because after all, if you think of a 30-minute or an hour TV show, and I'm thinking of one of these whodunits kind of things, Murder, She Wrote, or any one of your favorites, all those things that you may watch, or your children watch, or you claim you don't watch, but maybe you do. They're all made up of individual episodes, and there's very little time given between them. They jump from one to another, and they put clues in it to help us know that it goes along. In a TV show, usually at the beginning, you have a couple of tracks. You have one track that is sort of the main theme, and then you have whatever is going to be the counter theme. For example, you may see the murder in the very first scene, or the crime committed. And then you see our detective friends who are sitting around their office or on their yacht or whatever they happen to be doing. And maybe then you see the crooks again doing so and so. And for a while you kind of alternate back and forth between these two lines. But gradually they come together. And finally, in a TV series, you have your big scene. And in a 30-minute thing, that comes usually 14, 18 minutes into the production. And there is a fairly long scene in which there is a major confrontation. You've got a lot of action, maybe the big chase, whatever it is. And then usually a number of quick further scenes in which the results of this down at the police station or jumping in the car and driving over to so-and-so's house because suddenly they become a suspect. And then you get to those final scenes, the one where first it is, all right, Mrs. Jameson, we know you did it.
You'll never take me alive!
And then the guns come out and and all this. Here's the one scene. And then finally, you get that last relaxed scene. Well, Edmund, how in the world did you ever know that it was Mrs. Jameson?
Well, it was really quite easy. You recall that at such and such time.
Or the elementary, my dear Watson, in the literary scene. Always the sort of the scene that that lets you know how it all was solved. Those final scenes. And then there's that crisis moment where you want to turn it off, and the kids always say, no, wait, there's going to be one more. And sometimes after the commercial, there is indeed a final wrap-up scene, or a tip-off what next week is going to be, or sometimes nothing. And that's kind of the way they lead you through to make sure you watch that last commercial before it's all over. Now, so you see, TV really is very much like real life, as they all tell us, except for the commercials, which I have put in here. Now, Mark, and I would like to mark on this sheet, but my magic marker is not so magic this time. The Gospel of Mark follows this dramatic pattern. And please. No, no. Well, anyway, chapters 1 through 3 are the kind of setting the scene, getting to know the characters, getting to know the good people from the bad people, and getting the conflict shaped up. That's what we're going to be talking about today. Then those characters interact. Those figures and those issues are played with up until a major scene, which is chapter 8, verses 27 to 30, the confession of Peter, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. 8, 27 to 30. That is the turning point of the book, because after that, the issues and the chief characters shift subtly. So after 8, 27 to 30, we come into a period of where there are a number of successive scenes, and finally we come to the showdown scenes of lesson. Let's see if it works. No. This. Oh, great. 1 to 3. Climax scene, 8, 27 to 30. And then these scenes at the end, first the chapters 11 through 15, and chapter 16 is this phantom scene at the end. So basically, Mark moves from this cluster of sort of getting acquainted with people through a period where the plot thickens to a climactic scene here, turning point. Then it relaxes for a little bit, but then it builds again, and then you have this final section where Mark suddenly becomes very time conscious. And instead of saying, and thereafter, and suddenly, and immediately, and straightway, we get, it was the sixth hour, and we get to the first, we get a whole week, the final week in Jerusalem, which is very clearly marked out in Mark. It's just as though we go into kind of a slow motion to kind of make sure you see every event and see it clearly. The Gospel of Mark is very carefully constructed out of these some 75 or 80 snapshots. Okay, are you kind of with me so far as to the structure of the book? Okay, now, we put together such a drama not to make money, not to sell soap, not to amuse people. The Gospel of Mark was written because people had problems. They had questions. Mark was not written to satisfy our curiosity about the chronology of Jesus' life. It was written to Christians who were new Christians, a generation or two after Jesus' own ministry, and they were facing a bunch of difficult questions. And the questions that Mark tries to deal with, they're different from the ones that Luke or Matthew uses. Luke and Matthew are also written with this snapshot approach, but they put the collection together differently because they're trying to make a different point. For Mark, the questions relate to this business about if Jesus is really the Messiah, which is the claim of the Christians. Jesus is the Christ. Well, if that's so, then there are a lot of questions that have to be answered. And basically, these are some of the questions. If Jesus was a long-awaited Messiah, then why didn't people flock to him instead of attacking him? If Jesus now brings the kingdom of God, which is all the good things we say it is, why did people not accept that kingdom and that Messiah, that Christ? Or, if Jesus was the Messiah, how could he have been killed by anybody at all? After all, if one is the Holy One of God, if one is God incarnate, then it's not easy to die. It's been a problem for Christian theologians ever since. And it's a problem that still, both of these first questions are questions that college students, high school students now, I guess, probably, continue to argue about late into the night. And then the final question, if Jesus is the Messiah, why do his followers still have to suffer? What was happening to Christians in those early years? And if, in fact, they were the new way of the kingdom of God coming, then why weren't things working out better? Because all of you who watch TV know that if you believe in God and put your hand on the TV set, you will be cured of all your diseases. And good things will happen to you. I mean, the whole Jim and Tammy Baker psychology is built on the fact that if Jesus is the Messiah, you will not have to suffer. God wants you to have fun and be rich and drive your big car.
And send him money.
And send more money. God wants Jimmy and Tammy to be rich. Maybe not you, but you can be happy because you know they're happy. And I start sending money. But, I mean, this is irrational. And that's why those groups that say that if you believe in God, you're going to have a happy and good life are so persuasive. And yet the Gospel of Mark is saying, no, The fact that you are suffering is in fact a sign that you are a disciple. Just the opposite of what sells. Okay, so these are the questions. Now you'll notice that all the questions begin with a assumption. If Jesus was along the way of Messiah, if Jesus was the Messiah. The Gospel of Mark starts out by trying to make clear to us that in fact Jesus is the Messiah. So that, first of all, this assumption is nailed down, that Jesus is indeed the Messiah. Once that's clear, that's what we're going to be talking about and looking at particularly in chapter 1. Once that is clear, then all these questions have to be answered. The rest of Mark, then, is the attempt to deal with those questions and to explain why those things happen. Now, you know the answers to all these because you've read Mark and heard Mark preached and spoken about all your life. But let's think back, and maybe as we go through it, we'll discover some new angles in Mark. So I want you now to have a chance to do a little work on Mark in chapter 1. Now I know the light in here is what we used to call a dim religious light, and so it may be hard for some of you to see. I know I suddenly realized that I've gotten to the large print text phase of my life, and I don't have a large print text here. So I will understand that some of you can't follow along too well, but I'm going to suggest we do this. We're going to do what you do always in musical groups. We're going to divide into four. Let's see what kind of a balcony we got up here. We got enough for one group in the balcony. That's going to be group one. And then group two, how about around here? And if you don't know which side you're on, it doesn't matter. Just pick. And then group two, group three, and we'll divide here, and this will be group four. So all this will do will let us look up different texts. We're not going to ask you to do a little buzzing because it's going to be hard to arrange that, at least today, particularly up there. The buzz would be difficult. What we're going to do is be able to look at different snapshots this way. We have four different snapshots, and then we're going to combine the knowledge we get and just see how those four snapshots all reinforce each other to make a specific point. Okay? I hope you all found Mark, M-A-R-K. Look at verse 1, chapter 1. This is the good news about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Okay? Is there any question about the identity of Jesus? It begins by stating this identity in a way that none of the other Gospels does. Jesus, and remember, Christ is not his last name. Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. If Jesus was along the way to Messiah, Mark says this is a good news that indeed Jesus is the Messiah. Okay, now, in order to establish that more fully, Mark gives us four snapshots. And I'm going to ask group one, that's the group upstairs, and you are going to have a hard time looking at this overhead, but I will give you the instructions for rally. I'd like you to look at verses 2 to 8 up there and ask your, and also if you would check Malachi 4, 5, and 6. That's an easy verse to find. It's the last two verses in the Old Testament. Malachi 4, 5, 6. And then the other verse is 2 Kings 1, 8. So, verses 2 to 8. Next time when I didn't use my head. Shouldn't have made you group one. Verses 2 to 8, Malachi 4, 5, 6, 2 Kings 1 to 8. And the question there is, as you look at that, what does this imply about who Jesus is? What does this set of verses lead to as the conclusions to who Jesus is? And I think Malachi 4, 5, and 6, and 2 Kings 1, 8 will help you see that. Now, group 2 over here, I've suggested you look at verses 9 to 11, which follow those. And I've suggested that Psalm 2, 7 might be a relevant text as well. And there again, I'm interested in what does it imply about Jesus? What title is given to Jesus, or what do you learn about Jesus' identity from that section? Verses 12 to 13 would be group 3. This has to do with a fall account, a reversal of the account of the fall in Genesis. So as you read those two verses, think about opposites to the fall, and I'll kind of help you look at those. and group four verses 21 to 28, who knows what? That is, it's clear that certain people know something about Jesus and others don't. So take a look at those, read them over, and then we'll just kind of get a group reading on them.
Second Kings
1:8. Okay, let's see what we can find. First of all, then, establishing Jesus' identity. Verse 1 calls him the Christ, Son of God. Okay, verses 2 to 8, what's it about? What's it a snapshot of? Who is the main figure? Just hear it here.
John the Baptist.
John the Baptist.
Yeah, John the Baptist. Excuse me, your number one is upstairs, right? Okay. What does it imply about Jesus' identity when you read that 1 to 12 section? What is John's role?
Forerunner.
Anybody awake upstairs? I guess we're done.
Forerunner.
Who is he supposed to be? Why did I ask you to look at that 2 Kings passage?
He's the one that follows Elijah.
Elijah. He was wearing an Elijah suit.
Right?
Elijah is described in 2 Kings as to what he wore. And it's interesting that the description of John is parallel to that classic description. And the reason is that the emphasis is made that John is now the fulfillment of that prophecy at the end of the Old Testament. What does Malachi say to the folks down here who didn't get to read that? Just give them a brief. What did Malachi 4:5-6 say?
Elijah's going to come before the end.
Okay. So there's the way the Old Testament ends is that Elijah will come before the great day of the Lord. And now there's an effort here to identify John with Elijah, which means then that Jesus has to do with the great day of the Lord. And remember, Lord in the Old Testament is God. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name. It's not Jesus. You speak of Lord in the Old Testament, the day of the Lord, it's God's coming. Okay, so there's an effort here made to show the parallel between John and the prophet Elijah so that people would feel that what is told about Jesus now has to relate to this end time. So let's now pick up the story of Jesus, which happens then in the next passage, which is now downstairs. Okay, what was your section about? What's the snapshot?
The fact that Jesus is indeed the Son of God.
Okay, what happens? What's the event?
Baptism.
Baptism of Jesus. Okay? So we move from John the Baptist to the baptism of Jesus. And what is there any title given to Jesus? Is there any... What does God say
He's
about
the Son.
Son. Okay, so here. Son of God now is validated by the voice of God. Thou art my son. This day, in whom I'm well pleased. And Psalm 2 is that same statement made to the kings of Israel. Okay, the baptism. Now, after the baptism, then we move to what's the next snapshot? Group 3.
Temptation.
Temptation. All the Gospels move from the baptism of Jesus to the temptation. Now, it's kind of surprising, isn't it, how short this account is in Mark. It's only 3 verses, isn't it? 2 verses, 12 and 13. So there's not a lot of emphasis now on all the 3 questions and all of this. So Mark is obviously using this only as a kind of quick picture of the purpose or the result of what happens in the temptation. Mark doesn't go into all the questions, if thou art the Son of God, do this or that, because for him, that's already concluded. He knows. He's told us. Now, in the temptation of Adam and Eve, it was a temptation to obey God or disobey God, and at the end, the Spirit stands with a flaming sword and drives them out of Eden into the wilderness. Now, where does this take place? Does Mark describe where the temptation of Jesus takes place?
No.
It's in the wilderness. So we start now at the opposite place from where Eden was. We start out in the wilderness. Okay? Now, in the biblical account, Satan wins in the Old Testament. Satan tricks Adam and Eve into disobeying God. What's the result here? We all know, right?
Just the reverse.
Just the reverse. Jesus, in fact, now obeys God. So that reverses man's disobedience. And that, of course, is something that Romans will pick up very, very directly. It becomes a very strong Christian picture that Jesus reversed the sin of Adam and Eve. Okay? In that story, part of the curse was that the beasts of the field would now be against Adam and Eve, and they'd have to, you know, work in the sweat of their brow and all that. What is the role of the beasts in these 2 verses?
Minister to them.
With the beasts, there's no conflict. And then the Spirit of God, the angel rather, remember in the Garden of Eden, the angel kept them out. The angel was the sword wielder who stood at the garden and wouldn't let them back in. Now, what's the role of angels here? Here, now the angels become, in effect, the servants of, they minister to Jesus. So in 2 verses, we have a total switch, and almost every word in those 2 verses is selected to remind us that what was undone in Genesis is now done rightly in Jesus dealing with the tempter in the wilderness. Okay, now we come, so that's the temptation, and is there any reference to, Jesus is not referred to by any, there's no dialogue there, is there? It's just description. But we can say, use the term that's often used, the second Adam, that is that he rights the wrong of Eve. Okay, now we skip. You'll notice that we've been consecutive. We skipped a few verses. The reason we do this is that in order to tell the next healings of Jesus, which involve some of Jesus' disciples, Mark has to describe the calling of 4. It's very economical. We don't get 12 because we don't need 12 yet. In fact, the calling of the 12 is going to be a part of the conflict that will come. It's a part of this issue of Jesus and his people. So here we only get 4, but there's a little story about how those 4 are called, because they are going to be part of the healings that Jesus does in Capernaum. Jesus has to heal Simon Peter's mother-in-law, for example. Well, who's Simon Peter? Well, we have to get him into the story. So 4 of the disciples are introduced so that we can get to these next events. And then comes this story of the man with an evil spirit. So we come now to the first healing. Okay. Now, this is an interesting one. What do you learn about Jesus' identity in this? Who knows who Jesus is in this? The unclean spirits. Now, God knew,
this is my beloved son,
remember the voice of baptism? Now the spirits, the evil spirits know, and they call, what do they call Jesus?
Holy One of God.
Holy One of God?
Holy One.
Does everyone's Bible say that? Does some other make translations different?
Messenger.
What?
Holy Messenger.
Holy Messenger, yes. There's one that speaks of Holy Messenger. Okay? Now, the demons know that. The demons recognize who Jesus is. How about the people? What does the account say about the people? What do they know at this point? The ordinary folks, not the supernatural beings.
Authority.
They see his authority, but they are puzzled. Right?
Surprised.
Yeah. Awed, amazed. There are several question marks in verse 27. What is this? Is this some kind of new teaching? This man has authority to give orders to the evil spirits, and they obey him. So we have a division then. The demons identify, the demons know who Jesus is, but the people are puzzled. So there have been now clues as to who Jesus is. And if you look down to the verse 34, Jesus has done considerable healing, and there are many snapshots of that, not all of which we have described. But notice now, verse 34 kind of summarizes where we are. Jesus healed many who were sick with all kinds of diseases and drove out many demons. He would not let the demons say anything, because they knew who he was. So the first answer to the question, why did people attack Jesus, who was really the Messiah, is that they didn't know who he was. They were confused. And we'll see that that will become more exciting as we go along. Now, chapter 1 ends with some more of those stories of Jesus' healings. So, to sum up where we are so far, we can say that Mark tries to show in this first chapter that the reconquest of creation, which was lost in Adam's day, is now begun. The kingdom of God is asserting its power again in a sinful world. And we know that Jesus is God's agent in the battle. Just like in the TV shows, we often know more than the characters in the drama know, because we see both sides. We see what's going on the criminal side, we see what's going on the detective side. So here we have that omniscient vision. We can see everything because Mark has helped us do that. He does that in order for us to understand what the problems are that Jesus will confront. But what now is going to happen when Jesus carries this battle into the daily life of Galilee? In chapter 2, now I would call chapter 2, meanwhile, in another part of town. Chapter 2 is that classic element that you see so often in such material. Classic element where we now begin to see the enemies, we begin to see the opposition forming up, and we begin to discern that the story is not going to be as quick or easy as we first thought. There's going to be a conflict. This is done in a series of confrontations in which, first of all, Jesus keeps on doing what he was doing. He keeps on healing. He keeps on helping, casting out demons. But now, instead of just people going around saying, "Why am I? What's going on?" we begin to have the germ of opposition. And as you can see, I've listed four of these snapshots, which are the content of chapter 2.
chapter 2 simply does the same thing four times. And you're going to ask us to look at those, and I've placed some questions before you. So we're going to ask Balcony,
work up,
1 through 12, please. You've got the longest task. I always make it hardest somehow for you. Verses 1 through 12, there are three questions. What's the argument about? Who are the opponents? And what title is given to Jesus? What role is Jesus assigned? Okay, what's the argument? Who are the opponents and what role is Jesus assigned? Okay, now you folks down here, you can see your assignments yourselves. Group 2, verses 13 to 17, the same questions. The questions are listed here at the bottom. Group 3, you continue with verses 18 to 22. And group 4, verses 23 through 28, the same questions.
Mr. Anderson,
yes.
I need to raise that so we can read the bottom line.
This? Or the whole thing?
Well, just the three questions.
Yeah, I can do the whole thing now. We've got chapter 2. Is that better?
Thank you. That's better.
Please feel free to do that if I'm in the way. Or I'll try to write. I'll get better used to this machine and size tomorrow. Write bigger. Okay, I think most of these passages are pretty familiar to you, and so we'll collect our information now. What's the argument about, folks, upstairs in verses 1 through 12?
Forgiving sin.
Yeah, and
authority.
Okay, authority to forgive sins. They don't mind his healing, see? To forgive sins was the power of God alone, and they consider that he talks about forgiving sins. What's the word they use about that?
Blasphemy.
Blasphemy. All right. So our good miracle worker here, who was okay as long as it was simply a matter of Medicare, now gets into trouble because he starts meddling with religion. Okay. And who are those who make this accusation of blasphemy?
Scribes.
All right. Scribes. You know that we learned about them from the time we were in Sunday school. But it's not the people, the scribes. And what title is given to Jesus? What role does Jesus play here? What's he called?
Son of Man.
Son of Man. And who calls him that? Jesus calls himself Son of Man. Now there's been more ink written, I guess, spilled on what the meaning of Son of Man is. And all we have to say is here, if it's been confusing to scholars ever since, it was probably from the beginning a kind of enigmatic title. It was something that did not disclose his identity. He refers to himself as Son of Man. And there were traditions that saw the Son of Man as a kind of great figure of the end time, a great justifier who would come and set everything right. But it was also a term that could be used, O Son of Man, simply meaning, O human being. So The identity of Jesus is not nearly as clear now in chapter 2. He does not call himself Messiah, Son of God, or any such thing. Now let's look at the next section. What is the argument here, group 2?
Arguments over who's righteous and who isn't.
Right. Okay, now it's who is righteous? Righteous. Who is a sinner? And Jesus is inclusive, if we can use a term frequently today. He was objected to because he was a friend of sinners. Who did that? Who are the objectors?
Pharisees.
Now we have another group, Pharisees. Again, familiar to you. Okay. And what title? Is there any title used here? Any phrase about it?
Physician.
And again, who uses it?
Jesus
about himself. He talks about, you know, those who are well don't need a physician. Okay, very interesting title. Okay, physician. Son of man. Okay, this is a story about Jesus and calling Matthew, a tax collector, and that's how Matthew gets into the picture. So we have a little history, a little incident, which adds to the disciples, but we also, it is a conflict story on the pattern of everything in chapter 2. So now let's look at the next one, group 3. What's the issue here? What's the argument?
Fasting.
A ceremonial question, as the other two were, in a sense. The authority to forgive sins, who's clean and who's unclean. Now it's a question of fasting. And who does it or who doesn't do it. Now, who are the questioners here?
It's not real clear.
It's not real clear, is it? But what does it say? What is the word used?
People.
Or in some, I think it says some. Maybe one of your translations says some. Okay. So here, it's not, you see, stereotype, but it's just the scribes and Pharisees. There were those who objected to his fasting. Now, what is his title here? And who gives it to him?
Himself.
Every title so far in this section is Jesus speaking of himself, and he never uses the same title twice yet. Just to protect myself as a historian. Once was with a history professor, and they said, as a historian, sir, would you predict what is going to happen in the next 10 years? And he said, as a historian, I know one thing, that you never can predict what's going to happen in the next 10 years. So I'm always a little cautious about these things. Okay, so far then, the issues have all been ritual or theological issues. They have never questioned his power to be able to heal. But there is a group of people who object to his ritual freedom. They don't like his way of not doing things according to the book. And at the same time, Jesus refers to himself with a number of odd titles. He never said, well, I'm the Messiah, so shape up. Okay, finally then, we come to number 4. Group over here. What was your issue? What were they? Pardon?
Working on the Sabbath.
Sabbath.
That's a dish team.
Yeah. Dish team. Okay, now, you know, I've been a little surprised at the amount of time given in these Gospels, particularly Mark, to the Sabbath issue. Seems like that was the worst possible thing Jesus could do, was to do something on the Sabbath. And I would think that healing in the name of God, for, you know, forgiving sins, might be considered worse, because that was called blasphemy. But think for a minute now, if you are an early Christian congregation worshiping out of a Jewish setting, one of the issues that must have been most cutting and difficult was, why do you not observe the Sabbath? Why do you use the first day of the week? And so maybe that's why the stories about Jesus' attitude toward the Sabbath are so important to the early Christians, and why we hear so much about it. He's already healed once on the Sabbath in Capernaum. We didn't read that account.
Now here he does it again. And who are the opponents?
Pharisees.
Who get them on that? Just the Pharisees? And so, I'm going to put Pharisees. No, I'm not going to quit with that marker. That's why I'm mad. Okay, the Pharisees again. They are, as you know, whipping boys in a lot of New Testament accounts. So we've met them already. The issue is the Sabbath, the opponents of the Pharisees, and what is the title used of Jesus?
Son of Man.
And who gives it to him?
Jesus
himself. Okay, we're back.
There's a second title there too, isn't there?
Second, yes, what is that?
Lord of the Sabbath.
Yes. Son of Man and Lord of the Sabbath. Now, remember that this was written down after the resurrection. And the term Lord of the Sabbath would be particularly precious to early Christians who want to make clear that they are not anymore ruled by the old law. Their Lord is Lord of the Sabbath. But Son of Man, we had that up here, comes up again, given by Jesus, a kind of mask, a kind of hidden identity which he wears at this point. Not clear at all who he is, but calls himself also in this passage Lord of the Sabbath, which of course would be very precious later. But we've got physician, bridegroom, Lord of the Sabbath, Son of Man. Now, this material has taken us through chapter 2, these snapshots. We want to conclude today by looking at chapter 3, the first six verses, because it does the same thing again. Notice first, it's a healing. Man with a paralyzed hand. But there are, verse 2, people who wanted to accuse Jesus of doing wrong. We're getting now a group of opponents. And the question is whether he will cure on the Sabbath. So it's a healing, but it occurs at the wrong time. Some people just never get their timing right. The result of this confrontation is verse 6, and it serves as the kind of summary of what we've come to so far. So, verse 6 says, the Pharisees left the synagogue and met at once with some members of Herod's party, and they made plans to kill Jesus. Now, we are in chapter 3, verse 6, and we have already got the whole plot set. We know who the opponents are. We know who Jesus is. We got this vast bunch of people in the middle, the people, who don't know. The disciples are just coming on the scene. We have Jesus healing, universally praised for that, but now opposed by a small group for his failure to do things according to the right way. It's not his claims, but his breaking of the law, because he's made no claims about himself. He calls himself these strange names. But we now know that this is a game for keeps. And so that's where we're going to leave it today. You can read the rest of chapter 3. We will pick up the story in chapter 3 tomorrow. I want to leave a little time if some of you have some questions or observations. You don't have to make questions. I mean, you may have discovered something in reading this you'd like to share, or you may not agree with what I've said. I'm only a college president. I'm not a teacher, so I don't know. Yes. Father,
is it possible that Jesus was purposely trying to confuse these people just to mix them up?
I think it's quite clear that at this point, I wouldn't say purposely trying to confuse, but Mark certainly gives a picture that Jesus does not want his identity to be clear at this point. Now, why that is, it's hard to say.
Why is that true?
Well, I can't say, but it's clear that Jesus tells the demons, we didn't read, we probably should just look back. Well, we did, didn't we? We looked at 1:34. He would not let the demons say anything.
because they knew who he was. Jesus is a part of this attempt at this point not to make his identity that clear. And why that is, I can't say, but it is interesting that Mark's gospel is built around this identity question, and the breakthrough that occurs in chapter 8 becomes a turning point. So it's as though Jesus wanted to get some history out there. He wanted to show himself as healer and friend of sinners and all that without making the claim yet.
Doesn't that all play into the whole messianic secret sort of thing too?
That's the title that's often given to this, the messianic secret. I've called this session today a secret identity, because I think it's clear that Jesus wanted, in Mark's idea, wanted not to make that clear at this point. Why? Maybe we've got some other theories.
Well, I heard an opinion expressed once about the messianic secret being more in keeping with the origin of the book. That's the line that you were taking there. For instance, the disciples are the ones closest to him, and they are the ones that don't know what's going on at all, because he always tells them not to tell anyone that he's the Messiah, or they act like the dummies. They're the ones that don't get the point that he's the Messiah, and they're the ones that are closest to him. And at least the theory I heard was more in keeping with the fact that if this is truly a missionary document, in other words, the purpose of the book of Mark is written to Christians who have newly become Christians, then it is clear there that even the people who have been there the longest don't really have the keys and answers to what has happened. So in other words, the invitation for everyone to come in, in other words, there's no testing beforehand. You don't have to know everything about Jesus in order to be a part of what's going on.
Now, that's a very helpful insight, because indeed, as we read it, the disciples don't have a very, very privileged role. It would be easy. One thinks from the beginning, well, I would be a better disciple than they were. Mm-hmm. That's probably not a bad thing for new Christians to feel. I can do it. I mean, I can follow. I understand better than they did. But Mark clearly makes this distinction, and maybe partly to help us understand why it was that Jesus did not get great popular following immediately. That's one of the questions. Why didn't everybody follow? One answer would be, well, Jesus tried to keep it a little quiet at first. Yes, ma'am.
Jesus didn't want to be crowned as king. And I think he had to keep from being identified in a physical role prematurely, because had they recognized him as the Messiah, they might have immediately cut short his mission.
Or one could take the other side, that they would be overwhelmed by his power and follow him for the wrong reasons, which was, as you were speaking, I was thinking, well, that's God's way, isn't it? Not overwhelming us with power, but coming gently, coming as a child, coming incognito. See, Jesus doesn't, Mark doesn't spend a lot of time talking about Jesus' infancy and all that business about coming as a child and humble and all that. But he still starts with a Jesus who is very, very subtle in his ways of dealing with people. He's trying to talk about the kingdom coming and not identify himself as the Messiah. Yes?
One of these 500-page Bible study courses that I carried around.
Did you lose weight?
Unfortunately, I didn't.
Oh, yes.
I didn't send it back, though.
But you got some answers.
Well, that material would suggest that it's not maybe so much a secret as what goes on is contrary to people's expectations and anticipations, and they point to verse 10 in the first chapter at the baptism, and says that this voice combines two otherwise separate traditions from the Old Testament. There's an enthronement psalm in Psalm 2 that you have on the chart, but then there's also the first verse of Isaiah 42, which is a servant psalm. And in the Old Testament, though there are two very separate strands, the king, the Messiah, is not a suffering person. The king is one who has many stables and much to eat and commands much power. The suffering servant tradition is quite a contrasting role. And in the baptism of Jesus, these two were brought together. Well, that would confuse or run contrary to anybody's expectations at that point in time. So it's not so much a secret as this guy is really not doing what he should do, or how can he do what he does, or this isn't fit together.
Mm-hmm. That in line with that, one could maybe say or suggest that it's not so much a conscious attempt to confuse as to qualify the term Messiah. Because that popular notion that one finds in Psalm 2 associated with the Davidic dynasty was very much current in Jesus' time, because here now you find people smarting under the Romans and the Zealots and the Zechariae and others very eager to locate a Messiah who would deliver them from the Romans by bashing heads. During Bar Kokhba's revolution, about 100 years later, they found one who did just that, and Jesus very much wants to dissociate himself from that. And I think you're dead right to point to the suffering servant songs as a major qualification 500 years earlier to the messianic title. The true deliverer, Messiah, will not be the one who comes with dazzling chariots, but one with patient suffering as God's presence among the meek of the earth rather than the powerful. I think that's very insightful. That was worth all 500 pages, I think, alone.
Yes, would we be comfortable if Jesus was scared? You know, what would happen if he...
Yeah.
I think he was scared.
You mean along the lines of, I'm going to blow my mission?
No. Not knowing what it was going to be like. He needed this background all the way up to chapter 8 to get the gumption to turn south.
I want us to stay with this feeling of uncertainty about what Jesus is up to, because that's exactly where the people are at this point in the text. So I want us to I want you to remember this feeling today of what's going on here. Why is he doing this? And remember this business about servant, because it is interesting that at the point where the identity of Jesus is described by the disciples, then we start talking about servant. And there's a whole strong teaching element that suddenly comes in about this new concept. But let's just remember today the way we felt as we read this. What's he up to? What is he doing? And that feeling is going to help us understand the feeling of the people as we go into the chapters tomorrow. Okay, I think we're about time to quit.
Nice to have her. She's an outstanding chef. Stay there.